animal, talking animal.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest today is Dr. Eleanor Spicer Rice, an entomologist by training, who over the years has been a guest on the show multiple times. Not coincidentally, she's a big favorite of Talking Animals listeners and this host. In the past, you've probably heard her discussing ants, spiders, homing pigeons, and microbes. Wait, microbes? Indeed, her previous book, Unseen Jungle, The Microbes That Secretly Control Our Lives, delved deeply into the realm of microbes. She's written a new book, primarily intended for young readers, as was Unseen Jungle, called Your Pet's Secret Lives, The Truth Behind Your Pet's Wildest Behaviors. Employing a breezy conversational manner, Spicer Rice explains surprising, sometimes truly revelatory bits of data about an array of pets ranging from the classics, dogs and cats, to parrots and other birds, goldfish, hamsters, snakes, bearded dragons, and more. And let's just say that if I were a tarantula, I would be deeply frightened of being attacked by a tarantula hawk. We'll discuss why that is, other aspects of your pet's secret lives, illustrated, by the way, by Rob Wilson, an award-winning artist with a beguiling style. He also illustrated her Unseen Jungle book, and some of its other fascinating disclosures when I speak with Dr. Eleanor Spicer Rice in a moment here on Talking Animals on WMNF. Meanwhile, coming up later in today's program, I'll talk with Forrest Hecker, a community educator who will be teaching him a class called Florida-Friendly Landscaping for Wildlife and Pollinators on June 27th in Sarasota. Those who enroll are likely to learn how to attract birds, bees, butterflies, and other small animals to their landscapes, and just generally how to go about designing a beautiful wildlife garden. Learn more about this class when Forrest Hecker joins us a bit later in today's show. Right now, though, let's discuss the new book, Your Pet's Secret Lives, with its author, Dr. Eleanor Spicer Rice, with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Let's welcome Dr. Eleanor Spicer Rice back to Talking Animals. Good morning, Dr. Spicer Rice.
Good morning, Duncan. I'm so happy to hear your voice. Thank you for having me back today.
Yeah, I'm happy to hear yours as well, and I'm so happy that you're back. And congratulations on the new book, and I'm really looking forward to discussing it. But first, Your Pet's Secret Lives is your second book geared for young readers, second one in a row, in fact. So do we have a trend here?
Yes, we do. We've got a third one coming out after this.
See, you already anticipated some of my next questions, so I wondered if there was a third run coming up. So is that part of the series, the Your Hidden Life series?
It is. It's part of the series. The whole series is about beautiful parts of life that are going on all around us that you probably can't see unless you know how to look for it.
Yeah.
So this one's about pets. The next one's about how different to talk to each other.
How different what? Sorry, I think you dropped out a bit there. Sorry.
Oh, how different parts of life talk to each other, like plants or chickadees or squirrels or bugs. It just tells you, it teaches you how to listen to your yard, I guess, in the third book.
Okay, so things that are going on in your yard that you weren't thinking about.
How they talk to each other, yep.
Cool.
So you'll be able to decode their conversations.
Wow. Okay, do you need a decoder ring for that or just the book probably?
The book is your decoder ring.
Wow.
But it doesn't come in any Cracker Jacks. You just have to buy the book.
I see. So since we're just now getting the Your Pet Secret Lives book, is there a timetable for this third book in the series?
The third book will come out this time next year.
Okay, so about May, June of 2025.
That's right. Yeah.
I believe this, does beg the question, are you officially a YA author now?
I think it's turning into that, yes. I have a graphic novel series coming out early next year about all the animals that can kill you. And then I have this and two picture books coming out. So I think I've turned into a children's author.
I wish you could kick up your work ethic a little bit. Seems like you're kind of slacking from what I can gather.
I am kind of slacking.
Yeah. No, that's seriously, that's a lot of stuff on the horizon. That's great. Partly that you're aiming kind of more in this direction. I think we touched on this last time we spoke, but the answer may or may not be slightly different now. Because, I mean, I think part of this that we talked about last time was that you're a mom of two young kids. And is that partly kind of what's swayed you kind of more in this direction for your writing and other projects?
I think it might. I think it's that, and that children are an easier audience to get into when it comes to things like spiders and dog poop, because they're not as grossed out as grown-ups are. So that's a good window to help, you know, of life, to get somebody to jump in and love something the way that I love it. Not that I love dog poop, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, there is a sizable poop quotient in the new book, I guess we should say, but...
There is.
But,
there is a lot.
But again, some super interesting and in some cases surprising facts about poops.
It's poops for good.
Yeah, so we may get into that as well. So now, and do your kids? I assume they probably read and enjoy your books as you've been delving into.
I'm not sure that they've actually read them. Their friends read them and tell them what's in them. I give them to them, but I think they're so tired of listening to me talk about bugs all the time. And I think they're just kind of over the things that I have to tell them.
Thinking about it now that you've done two and you're obviously into the third coming up, et cetera, how do you write differently for young readers than you've written some of your previous books that weren't necessarily aimed at young readers?
Well, it's actually a lot more fun for me because I get to write like I talk, which is really great for me. And I also get to just pull out only the very best parts of a story and to tell the young people. They don't really need as much of the extra information yet as adults need. So that's really fun for me because it's all the highlights. You know, I mean, the book comes from really complicated scientific studies that you can check back and go and find them if you want to. But it distills it for you. It's like the Cliff Notes of fantastic things. That are
yeah, but I think you also might be underselling kind of what the impact of that approach is, because I think, as we also probably talked about last time in the wake of the previous book, these books, I think, work as some of the best other kinds of books and animation shows and other stuff do on sort of both levels. So, yeah, you can be a young reader and totally enjoy it and learn stuff and be appropriately grossed out or not, depending on what the particular item is that's being discussed. But you can also be an adult who's considerably older than that age group and also find the books really engaging and informative and often illuminating as well.
Thank you, Duncan. That makes me feel really good that you say that. I mean, for me...
But is that part of the secret aim now that we're having true confessions?
I do. Now that we're getting into it, I want the people, the parents and the children, or just the people just buying the book, I want everybody to get something out of it, because I did. I enjoyed writing these books so much because I learned so much wild stuff to me, and I want everybody to be thrilled, as thrilled as I was. Were you thrilled? Did you learn anything thrilling?
Yeah, no, I was wrong. My only concern is that the phone seems to drop out parts of your answer.
I don't know
if you're getting called at the same time or if we just don't have a great connection,
no.
But I may consider...
It sounds fine to me.
Yeah, no, it's just... It's
do you
very,
want to call me back?
Yeah, I might do that. I might just try a different line just because I would hate to have any distractions or anything going on here. So I might call you back and we'll pick it up in one sec. So we'll be right back with Dr. Eleanor Spicer-Rice on Talking Animals in just 2 seconds. Thanks. Okay, we're back on Talking Animals with Dr. Eleanor Spicer-Rice with hopefully a little bit better phone line. And Dr. Rice, are you there? Spicer-Rice, are you there?
I'm still here.
Okay. Well, let's hope this works better. So speaking of all, part of the fun and excitement is researching everything and delving in, let's discuss kind of some specifics about the new book. When you were researching, inevitably at least, had to decide what to leave out. I'm sure there's a lot more stuff that you found that would like be appropriate for the theme, but you just thought, well, there's just not room for this, or this is kind of similar to that. So are the things that you ended up not including that you want to address?
Most of the things, when we write about animals, like our pets, most of the things that I didn't include were related to pets that were strange, that most people don't keep, that I just thought were really neat. And some of it was, and the rest of it was related to mating behaviors, which is fascinating. I love all the weird mating behaviors that we all have. And so a lot of that I had to leave out and just stick with the things that children see most often.
I had to leave out the mating behaviors because it was aimed for younger readers?
People get upset when you talk about mating. A lot of this we talk about, like we talk about hamsters in this book, and a lot of the behaviors in this book are related to mating behaviors, but you just got to go a little bit light on it, more than the way that you would talk about it if we were talking to our friends about it.
Yeah. Well, but, thank God you did, because otherwise I'd probably have to report to you that your pet secret light was banned in Florida.
Oh, well, that might be a good thing, right?
Yeah, good for sales, but I mean, that's how nuts things are here, so.
Bad for the Floridians.
Right, or further embarrassment for the Floridians, yeah. So.
I feel like y'all are promoting literature in this way. I keep finding out a lot of good titles with all these banned books that y'all have going on.
Okay, well, that's good. It's things you can tuck away for future titles of your own, your Hidden Life series. By the way, is there a title for the book that's coming out next year, just to give it a huge sneak preview?
It's called Undercover Conversations.
Oh, wow.
And it's a lot of stuff. I didn't know that plants talk to each other, their body parts, using electrical pulses. I didn't know. Some of the stuff is so beautiful, and it's all very common, every single thing. Just like the stuff in this book. It's all stuff that happens every day.
Yeah.
But we just don't think about it.
All right. Well, I'll look forward to talking about that book in more detail when it's out. But let's focus on the one that's currently out, which again is Your Pet's Secret Lives, The Truth Behind Your Pet's Wildest Behaviors, written by our guest today, Dr. Eleanor Spicer Rice, and illustrated by Rob Wilson. Great, great illustrator and award-winning guy,
so
with a bunch of cool drawings throughout the book. So,
wonderful.
So did you start out, before even writing a word of this one, with some initial pets and secrets that you just kind of already knew that you wanted to include?
No. Duncan, I did not want to write this book at all.
Okay. Well, more true confessions. Yeah.
Yeah.
So who dragged you into this against your will?
Well, I made the proposal for the publisher for this series of cool things that are going around us, and I wanted to look like a real idea person.
Yeah.
Had a long list of possible books after it, and I just threw pets on there, and they picked pets, and I was so disappointed because I was like, we could do something way cooler than that. But then when I started writing it and looking at the research about our pets, because I have a lot of pets, you have pets, I mean, your listeners love animals, we feel like we know them very well because we spend our whole lives with them, you know?
Yeah.
But I was shocked by what I found. Like, this book has totally changed the way that I interact with my pets and that I view other people's pets, because it was a wonderful experience for me to learn so much while writing it.
So along those lines, as you were researching, otherwise kind of working on the book, what sort of animal information did you find most shocking then?
Well, I think one of the things that I found that was pretty amazing is how much of our pets' behaviors that seem kind of weird and pointless are actually tied to their ancestral survival skills. And they have, like, a purpose. Like, can we talk about the dogs going to the bathroom?
Sure. I figured it would be only a moment or two before we get to pooping of some kind.
We've got
to
get to number twos already.
Yep.
Early. So, you know, when our dogs go to the bathroom, they spin, and when they're outside, you'll see them spin one way and spin the other, and then they finally go. They just stop all of a sudden, and it seems random. But when researchers started watching it, it turns out that they are actually stopping where their bodies, most often where their bodies are aligned with the north-south axis, the Earth's electromagnetic field. And that's because they can detect the field, and they use the field to navigate. And animals that can detect the field just feel more comfortable and at rest when they're lined up with the north-south axis. So if you watch your dogs go to the bathroom, and all kinds of animals do this, naked mole rats, hammerhead sharks, cows, deer. If you ride by a pasture down there in Florida and there's a bunch of cows hanging out and everything's fine, there's no storm coming, they're going to be usually facing north, south, or south, north. And so it was really cool to me, because then I started watching my own dogs go to the bathroom. And sure enough, pretty much every single time, unless it's an emergency, they're facing north, south, or south, north.
Yeah.
Which is wild.
It was super fascinating. I had that in my list of brightly highlighted things. Because again, I want to be careful how many things we talk about, because I just want to be careful again about spoilers and just give reasons for people to delve into the book and find there's some of these discoveries themselves.
I think we could talk forever and not get to everything.
Oh yeah, no, I think that's true.
Don't worry.
But this one, I thought we could probably safely talk about, because you know, people think about magnetic field and things in different ways when it comes to animals or migration for birds or all kinds of things, but you wouldn't have really occasion to think about like when they're just doing their business, that they're actually lining up with the magnetic field before doing so.
Yeah, and it's something we can all watch if we have dogs or if we're watch dogs walking around outside. If we're lost, maybe it can help us find some sort of direction.
Yeah.
But yeah, and they thought the dogs would do it because we know that dogs can, some dogs can travel him, and cats too. I've heard that cats, but they haven't done this work with cats yet, can travel him from great distances over places they've never been before. And they didn't know exactly how they were navigating. But this is one of the things that clued us into the fact that they can detect Earth's electromagnetic field.
Yeah. Well, that kind of, this in a way reminds me that one of the many virtues of your pet's secret lives is that it expands or updates, I guess, really, our thinking on some long-discussed animal issues. For example, I'm thinking about, now we're not going to stick too much with dogs, but I'll just do one more dog thing maybe right now, which is dog's guilt face. You know, like when we get home, if we have a dog and the dog is dragged trash across the kitchen floor or torn to shreds a sofa cushion or done something else and appears to look guilty for this major misdeed. What we're really seeing, according to Julie Hecht, an animal behavior researcher that you interview in the book, we should mention there's a handful of interviews with experts of one kind or another interspersed in the book. But once again, I mean, do you want to talk about what she actually says is going on when we see the dog looking guilty?
Oh, yes. Yeah. So we think that they feel real bad about it when they go through the trash. But really, we've conditioned them because they know they've gotten in trouble about it before and they're trying to keep the peace. So it's an appeasement thing. And truly, if you look at your dog, you know, because they don't understand that they've done that. I mean, going through the trash is just something that dogs do. But If you look at your dog like that, they just look so pitiful. Like, you can't help but feel bad for them when they look at you after going through your trash or doing something.
Yeah, well, it's a very effective technique, for sure.
Oh, yeah, and so you forgive them immediately.
Yeah.
So you've conditioned them to kind of do this appeasement behavior, and then they've conditioned you to not get mad at them for doing something that's kind of off the wall. And it's really neat, and people won't believe it because, you know, I see my dog after he does Nature Boy, after he does some wild stuff, and I feel so sorry for him. Like, I almost want to, like, take it, you know, but really, they don't actually feel guilty about it.
Yeah. Well, that's because that's been debated, you know, one level or another for many years. And I think it was Julie Hecht, it's definitely in your book somewhere, probably this passage on this, where she's talking about as another way to kind of underscore how they're not feeling guilty, and it's just you thinking they're looking guilty, is that if you snuck in and did something like what the dogs would have done and kind of, you know, then came in later, like did it secretly. I love this thing about, like, that's how far you're going to kind of check your premise here. But so if you came in and after you kind of somehow secretly scattered trash or did something else like what they have done, and then they'd still have the same reaction, even though you know for sure that they weren't responsible because you did it, not the dog.
That's right. And they still look real pitiful about it.
Yeah, they show you the same guilt face, though. That's what's
right.
Amazing. So I think it further disproves that guilt face actually exists.
Either that or dogs are easily gaslit.
Yeah, well, there's that. But also, again, I think it also, we see how plugged in emotionally dogs are to their humans, right? Because they are reacting like they know something bad has happened, and whether they did it, in most cases, they did do it. But even on the setup thing that I just described, they didn't do it, and they still look like they've done something crummy. And that's just, I think,
a further measure. That's a really interesting point, and that's something that I never considered before writing this book, is that we've been keeping our cats and dogs for about 15,000 years. And we've been evolving together to understand each other. You know, they have been evolving responses to us, and we've been evolving responses to them. And so it's really cool to me, like when you're saying this, you know, like they, like how they're doing this between the two of us, or like with our cats, you know, our cats can tell our emotions, whether or not they want to make us feel good about it. You know, that's up to the cat, but
yeah,
our dogs and cats know how we feel about stuff, and we know how they feel about stuff. And if you took a wolf and you pointed down the street, the wolf would not turn his head. He is not evolved with humans. But if you pointed down the street for a dog, they're going to look to see what you're trying to do. You know, we have responses that go together with each other. And we're a lot more connected, I think, than many of us realize.
For sure. Well, that you're aware of some of that emotional connection, just if you have a dog living with you and you're excited about it. And
right.
But you don't necessarily think that it would manifest itself that way. So
right.
Yeah. Again, this is Talking Animals on WNF. If you just tuned in, my guest is Dr. Eleanor Spicer Rice, an entomologist by training and author of many books. You may have heard her on the show over the years discussing ants, spiders, homing pigeons, microbes even. And she's published a new book that we're discussing now called Your Pet's Secret Lives, The Truth Behind Your Pet's Wildest Behaviors. If you have a question for Dr. Spicer Rice or would like to offer a comment about your pet or your pet's wildest behavior, please call 813-239-9663, email dj@wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. So I made a reference to tarantulas early in the thing. So
yeah, they've got it going on. You know, Duncan, right this minute, I have a tarantula situation. I went out of town, and our tarantula, TJ, has left the building. We do not know where he is.
Oh, wow.
Every time we open a drawer, we just think, is TJ in there? We don't know. But
so when's the last time you saw him?
A week and a half ago.
Oh, my goodness.
So he could be anywhere. He's somewhere in our house. We don't think he's left.
Well, I hope he is somewhere in your house, because one of the things I was going to ask about, if I were a tarantula or thinking about becoming one, I think I would totally reverse course now that I know about the tarantula hawk.
Isn't that scary?
Yeah. Do you want to talk a little bit about what the tarantula hawk is and what it does, and hope that it has no bearing on your current missing tarantula?
Oh, yeah, we'll hope it doesn't. It's this beautiful, beautiful hawk. I mean, wasp. And they have these long stingers, and they have evolved to be big enough to get tarantulas. So what they do is they sting a tarantula, and the venom doesn't kill the spider, it just paralyzes the spider. And then it drags the spider down to a tunnel. And the spider's still alive, because if the spider had been killed, the spider would rot. So you want to keep its body alive.
If you're the tarantula hawk, you mean?
If you're the tarantula hawk, you need fresh meat.
Yeah.
So then she will lay an egg in the tarantula, and the tarantula hawk baby will squirm around in the tarantula's living body, eating all the non-essential tissue first. And then by the end of it, when it's cleared out the spider's body, it will then go for the essential tissue to finally kill the tarantula and pupate inside its body, and then burst out of the spider's, like the husk of the spider, and become a hawk again. I mean, a tarantula hawk, you know, to go and do the same thing. And it's relatively common. And actually, down in Florida, y'all have some wasps that do something very similar to this. Do y'all have, you know, the pipe organ wasps and the dirt daubers?
The dirt dauber sounds familiar. I'm not sure about the pipe organ wasps.
They're a type of dirt daubers. They do something very similar to this with theirs. If you open up those dirt dauber little things that they put on your walls, you will find them packed with paralyzed, alive spiders.
Wow.
And that's what they do. They travel around your yard trying to find spiders. Some specialize in garden pests like caterpillars, but a lot of them just like spiders. And they capture them, and they sting them, and they keep them alive, and they stuff them in those tubes, and then they lay their eggs on them, and their babies eat the living spiders until they emerge as adults.
Wow. Now, you bring up spiders reminds me, you include a secret, quote-unquote, of your own in the book, disclosing that you used to be afraid of spiders, right? Yet you went on to become an entomologist and write a book about spiders, et cetera. So the pivotal part of this, it seems to me, is how you faced and kind of overcame that fear. And it might be helpful to maybe share a little bit of that method right now.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know what happened for me. Are you scared of spiders?
No, but I mean, unlike you guys, I'm not sure how eager I'd be to have a tarantula hanging out at the house. So there's a certain point where I draw a line.
For what it's worth, we were a lot more eager to have the tarantula before he got out.
Yeah, no, I'm sure. Yeah, now he seems
don't
less
like
popular.
Him as much now, he's anywhere in the house. But what happened for me was, I wrote that spider book. I wrote a book about spiders, I was so scared of spiders that while I was writing the spider book, and I didn't tell people about, I mean, some people, my friends knew that I was scared of spiders, but I pretended like that they weren't scary because I didn't want other people to be frightened of nature. But I was so scared of spiders that when I would look up spiders for the spider book, I would scream. If, like, fishing spiders, the real creepy ones, they just made my heart race. They made me very nervous.
You mean just looking at a picture, like in a textbook or something, as part of your research?
Yes.
Wow.
I had one on my sun visor one time, and it freaked me out so bad that I ran my car off the road. I was so scared it was going to hit me in the face. And now thinking about that is just sounds like a different person to me. Because what happened for me, and I think this is this way with everything in life, whether it's spiders or people that you don't really know very well, or just what your fears is, that I learned about what the spiders were doing around us through writing the book.
Yeah.
And they became fascinating to me. And it wasn't immediate. It was over time. But then I started to pay attention to them instead of run away from them. And they're amazing. And then I started to care about them. And I started to, you know, want to be around spiders, which is kind of weird, except for TJ. I'd rather not. That's the tarantula in my house. I'd rather him be in his cage. But most spiders that are around are doing incredible, wonderful things.
Yeah.
And if you stop and look at them, and this isn't just with spiders, you know, I mean, it's with everything that you're scared of. If you take a minute and you pay attention and you learn about it, it's not so frightening. And it's actually usually pretty wonderful.
Well, so backing up a little bit, did you set out to write that book about spiders precisely because, at least at that moment, though it later changed considerably, you were afraid of spiders? Was that part of your, like, hey, one way I can maybe tackle this or beat this thing is delving into a book?
Chris Buttle, this is how shallow I am. This man named Chris Buttle.
Yeah. All right. He contacted you to write a book about spiders. Yeah, I remember that. We talked about that on the show many years ago.
That's
yeah.
Right. Yeah. I didn't want to tell him I was scared of him. So I didn't want to write that. It's just like the pest book. I wasn't really interested in writing it, but I wanted to work with Chris.
I see.
And I didn't want him to know what a baby I was about spiders. So I just did it. And
wow.
I didn't set out to even like spiders by the end of it. I didn't even care if I liked spiders by the end of it. I just was going through it. And then as I was learning about it, everything changed. And that has changed my life because it's really enriched the way that I go outside and the things that I see and how I experience the natural world. Because I used to be scared in the morning. You go out, the spider webs are everywhere. You're walking through everything.
Yeah.
You know, it's not gross. It's wonderful. And so it totally changed my life.
So that's great. So partly because you're ashamed to confess to Chris that, like, hey, I'm scared of spiders, even though you have this idea for us to work together on a spider book. So you forged ahead. Faced thereby kind of facing your fear of spiders and overcoming them, and now, like, super in awe of spiders.
Right, that's right. And that's,
well, again, I think there's an important lesson there that can be applied to far more than just spiders.
I think so too. Maybe some of the books are banning.
yeah, for example, for sure.
Yeah, just pay it. We all have the luxury that we can take a minute and pay attention and wonder about something.
Yeah.
Before we act about it.
Just take that moment.
That's what that taught me.
Yeah. Very good. Again, this is Talking Animals on WNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. I'm speaking with Dr. Eleanor Spicer Rice, an entomologist and author of several books. Most recently, Your Pet's Secret Lives, The Truth Behind Your Pet's Wildest Behaviors. I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj at wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. So I mentioned earlier that, kind of interspersed across the pages of the book, there are a handful of interviews with experts of various kinds. So one of those speaks to a pretty remarkable discovery about certain snakes. Can you talk a little bit about Warren Booth and discuss his discovery?
Oh, sure. Warren Booth is an amazing researcher. He's also an entomologist, but he kept snakes as a hobby. And as he was keeping snakes, he started to hear a rumor, because it had been documented that some reptiles can reproduce without mating. It's called parthenogenesis. And they didn't believe that snakes could do that. And Warren had a snake that reproduced without mating. And he started to look at the genetics behind it, and they're genetically, you know, have all of their mother's genes. And he started to reach out to other places and other people who were keeping snakes, and he found out that this is happening all the time. He finds it a lot. And since then, he's found that some certain alligators, crocodiles, can reproduce without mating. So it's pretty wonderfully strange, depending on how you feel about snakes. But it's amazing because he just paid attention to what was going on with his snakes. And it's totally changed the way that the textbooks are written. Because we were saying whoever writes the textbooks, science, was saying that that's not something that can happen. And it turns out that it is. And it's something that happens kind of frequently.
And it's really a significant discovery and, you know, all things considered, kind of pretty late in the day, right?
Right, yeah.
So that's...
But, you know, Duncan, like, that's the thing about science in general is that we're constantly, even right now, making discoveries. Like, they thought that turtles were quiet, for example. You know, that turtles are traditionally quiet animals. They don't do anything. Then they dropped microphones into ponds and rivers and everywhere and listened to them in infrasound. So ultrasound is outside of our hearing range on the high end, infrasound's on the low end. And it turns out that turtles are talking all day long. But we look at things through a human lens and we don't think about it like through the animal lens. You know, we think, oh gosh, turtles are quiet. Well, yeah. They're having conversations constantly, all kinds of vocalizations. And we just figured this out, like, in the last couple of years. So there's so much to discover and so much to wonder about. And it's amazing to me how much we don't know.
Yeah. Well, along those same lines, there was just something very recent, not brand new, but an updated piece of discovery or science, I guess, regarding elephants and how they communicate, you know, at frequencies that most of us, of course, can't hear except the other elephants, and they can go miles and miles and miles. Now, some of this, I think, was already known, but there was some other element just in the recent days that added more to our understanding about that. So it's exactly kind of what you're talking about.
And what they learned is that they have names. They have names for each other in the last couple of days. The elephants?
Yeah.
And that's
probably
amazing.
Probably not Dumbo, I'm guessing. They probably have something a little more interesting.
No, I listened to them. Did you listen to the recording? And their names were like, these weird sounds.
Yeah, it's hard for me to make out, but yeah.
And their mothers give them their names. They said they believe that the names originate with their mothers. Their mothers named them, and they called each other by these names, which
that's
is
great.
Amazing to me. The whole world has so many things that we're constantly figuring out. It's wonderful.
Yeah, I think at this rate, Undercover Conversations is going to be like a 12-volume set.
We'll have to keep coming up with the more, we'll just keep updating it.
Right.
All the extra conversations.
Well, there's a lot of conversational stuff even that we've touched on in this conversation. We're not even essentially talking about that book just yet, but we will.
Yeah, that's true.
Next year.
Elephants aren't in there. I hope so. Yeah, that's true. There is an undercover conversation in this book because we thought that mice only squeak. And then people started listening to them and they actually are extraordinarily loud. But they're talking in the ultrasound, not our sonic range. So where the turtles are talking too low for us, mice are too high for us. But it turns out that they roar at each other and they sing love songs to each other. And their songs are as loud as a helicopter or a jackhammer or a motorcycle. They're
the
really
decibel
loud.
Level was insane. I thought, how is that even possible?
Decibels.
Yeah.
But we just can't hear it.
It's like Judas Priest or something. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. That's what they're doing.
Wow. And also there's some things I recall about they don't like to be startled, which no one really does. But I thought it was interesting that there was, I think, a specific point made about mice don't like to be startled or caught off guard or something. Am I misremembering that? Maybe it was something like
no,
that.
No, they really don't. And they have little streaks that they do if you frighten them or you startle them. That you might not be able to hear because it's an ultrasound.
Yeah. So what else?
I used to have some mice, and I would listen to them with my bat transducer, and they are very complicated. Their little songs are very complicated.
All right. Now, speaking of that, not counting the touchy subject of the currently missing tarantula, can you run down the critter population currently residing at the Spicer Rice headquarters?
It's too high right now, but I have a flock of pigeons. We have
those are homing pigeons, correct?
Those are the homing pigeons. We just had one that was born this week, hatched this week.
Wow.
And then we have two dogs, and then we have TJ, wherever he may be. That's
right.
Angela.
Current status unknown.
Gecko.
Yeah.
Well, current status unknown.
Yeah, what did I
mean? And then a leopard gecko. But I have two little boys.
Right.
So we get these things, and then I'm the one that ends up falling in love with them. Like, I didn't know that you could adore a leopard gecko as much as I do, but this thing's really cute.
And what prompted somebody, either one of your sons or whatever, to say, hey, let's get this leopard gecko? I mean, how do they
Want everything. They want every animal.
Okay, so it sounds like you guys actually have very overlapping interests then. Because earlier you were trying to say that, or suggest maybe I misunderstood, that you tried to talk to them about stuff in the books and whatever, and it's like, well, maybe because it's their books that their mom wrote, but they didn't seem
just
super...
Yeah, they're part of me.
Yeah.
They like information. They just don't want to hear it from me.
Okay. If you could distribute it some other means, we'd be happy to...
If somebody else told them, they'd be thrilled.
Okay.
Yes.
So we'll just need to put a different cover on the book and hand it over, I guess. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Yes.
That's great. So tell me, like, your favorite story about discovering or researching or putting together this book and the revelation that came from it.
Well, I think that my favorite things from writing this book were the bits of creatures that I didn't really give much credence to, like fish.
Yeah.
And the things that I learned about them just were amazing to me, like how goldfish are extraordinarily intelligent animals, and they remember stuff for years and years and years, and they can be trained to do all these tricks. This team of researchers in Israel recently built a little fish car with little wheels on it and trained the fish to drive down the street to get food and go back their house, and they could do it. They trained them to go get takeout, and they can, and these things, you know, lead up to goldfish being extremely damaging when we release them in the wild, because they're so smart and they're so capable of doing things. But things like that, where I have underestimated so many of the animals around us, was extremely enlightening to me.
Yeah, because it sounds like, I mean, it's almost kind of nutty to picture the fish in some sort of vehicle going to get food when you know, DoorDash or one of these other places could have solved their problems. But also just the fact that, you know, all kidding aside, that you could train a goldfish to do that is pretty remarkable.
They're watching you. They remember you. They remember your friends coming in. They remember the sounds of your voice, and they can remember this stuff for years and years and years. And goldfish can live up to 20 years, and they can grow to be really big. And, you know, we don't treat them the way that as if they had these abilities. You know, we treat them as if they are just these random decorations in a jar, usually.
Yeah.
But they actually, you can forge a connection with these creatures, and you can watch them do incredible stuff.
And is it by watching them do some of those things? Because when you earlier said that they have great memories, like I thought then was like, how do you measure that, or how do you quantify the great memory of a goldfish? But I guess it's by what they
can navigate mazes. They can train them to do, to respond to certain stimuli.
So again, it's in terms of tasks that the memory becomes clear.
It's tasks and behavior observations, yes. So the problem is with us is that we dump them in the water when we don't want them anymore. And they're so good and they're at remembering stuff, and they're so smart and capable and adaptable that they cause a lot of damage in our ecosystems. And goldfish in a couple of generations revert back to their wild type, which is a carp about the size of a big shoe. And then they just destroy ecosystems, and they're wily, so they can outwit people who are coming in to harvest them out of the ecosystem. And they are now ranked as one of our planet's most destructive invasive species.
Wow. Well, We're so, unfortunately, sort of nearing the end of our time, Dr. Spicer Rice, but yep. I was just going to say that reminds me, of course, of what for us here is kind of a local story that's included in your Pet Secret Lives, which is the Burmese pythons and how they went from pet status to, of course, too big to have as a pet, and then people started saying, well, I'm just going to release them mostly in the Everglades, and now the Everglades are overrun by these giant snakes, so pets run amok, basically.
Oh, yeah, and they've eaten almost up to 99% of the Everglades small mammals.
Yeah, yeah, no, super invasive at that point, yeah.
Yeah, they're very good at being alive. They're not good at that.
Yeah.
And y'all are doing some pretty innovative stuff to catch them.
Yeah, we've had some of those innovators on the show, but they are up against it, man. I mean, you can innovate something, you come up with some different methods or just have contests to see how many, you know, Burmese pythons you can catch to sort of help reduce the population. And it all makes a dent, but that's all it is so far, is a dent.
Well, it's hard to spot them, too.
Yeah,
Having the sentinel snakes has been a pretty useful thing because they have these huge mating balls and they'll tag a male. And then they follow the male to the mating ball and kill everybody when they get there, except for the sentinel.
Yeah.
And that's been a really good way, but you've got to find the males to tag them. And it's just really, really hard because they're so good at blending in.
For sure. Yeah, they're wily, to use a word that you just use on a different species. But all right, well, shoot, I'm so sorry, but we have, I think, just about reached the end of our time. But we've been speaking with Dr. Eleanor Spicer Rice. Her new book is Your Pet's Secret Lives, The Truth Behind Your Pet's Wildest Behavior, where you can also learn how to use the possessive apostrophe and two parts of the title. And so Dr. Spicer Rice, that book, of course, is available anywhere you get your books, if I'm not mistaken, correct?
That's correct. And if they don't have it, ask for it.
All right. And there's also a website you could check out more stuff, spicerrice.com, and always on Instagram. And there's so many other places you can connect with Dr. Eleanor Spicer Rice, which I'm glad we just did now. Thanks again, Dr. Spicer Rice, for joining us on Talking Animals. Again, great talking with you as always.
Thank you so much. It's so great to talk to you, too. Take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
In a moment, I'll speak with Forrest Hecker, who is teaching a class called Florida Friendly Landscaping for Wildlife and Pollinators. That's happening on June 27th in Sarasota. There appears to be various facets to the curriculum of this class, this one-hour class, in fact, including learning how to attract birds, bees, butterflies, and other small animals to your landscapes. More about this class from its instructor, Forrest Hecker, in just a moment here on Talk Animals. Right now, though, we're going to step into the comedy corner with a piece from the wonderful Kevin Nealon. Maybe relevant to the weather issues that are happening in parts of Florida currently. This is Cows on the Roof from Kevin Nealon in today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals on WMNF.
Most animals are smart, although, you know, I remember during the tsunami in Sri Lanka, I read about this. The animals, they have like a sixth sense. They knew it was coming, and they took off for the hills the day before it happened. They all survived. They didn't tell anybody else. They kept it a secret. They're, come on, just us. Come on, keep it quiet. Move it along. Let's go. But I have a whole newfound respect for animals now. I give them a lot more credit. In fact, now when I see a dog chasing a car, I will chase that car too. Oh, yeah. Animals are something. I rescued a couple of cats not long ago. Hey, do your cats throw up all night long? Is that what they do? Is that the M.O.? I mean, all night long, all I heard was, whoa! And I wake up in the morning, and there is puke everywhere. It's like living in a fraternity house or something. You know, it's just crazy. And you know what? Not even puke. They're hairballs. And I know that because I sifted through it with a little stick. A couple of berries, but mostly hair. Mostly hair. Yeah. And you got to get it off the carpet quick. Otherwise, it stains. You've got to make a decision. Either get them off or let them accumulate and become like a sticky shag carpet after a while. Animals are smart. That's all I'm going to say. I watch the Weather Channel. They always show the floods in the Midwest, right? And they show the cow up on the roof, you know, surrounded by water. I don't know how she gets up there. I guess she comes up the stairs, I guess. Do they have stairs in a barn? I don't know. She comes up the stairs, crawls out the window, grapples up to the roof, just waits it out. They should show that. Maybe they should have the Cow Network. I'd watch the Cow Network. But even here in California, you know, the animals warn you before an earthquake. They'll start barking like crazy. The dogs, you know, the cats will hide under the cars. You just have to know the signals, what to look for. Okay, like if you live in the Midwest, right, and you're going down the stairs and there's a cow coming up the other way, you get the boots. You get the boots. It's common sense. Look at the guy in the back. Check him out. Check him out. What's he doing? But I'll tell you what's funny. No, seriously. Seriously. No, seriously. No, the guy in the back. The guy in the back.
Right, that was Kevin Nealon in today's Comedy Corner with a piece called Cows on the Roof, taken from his album Now Hear Me Out. Now it's time to speak with Forrest Hecker, who will be teaching a class called Florida Friendly Landscaping for Wildlife and Pollinators later this month in Sarasota. There's Forrest Hecker on Talking Animals on WNF. Good morning, Forrest.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals.
It's nice to be here.
Cool. So, as the instructor of this course, you're identified as Florida-friendly landscaping specialist. What does that mean exactly, and how does one qualify for that designation?
Well, the Florida-friendly landscaping program is, I believe, 31 years old now, and it's a program that was created by the state government to kind of, mainly it's to protect water quality and have better landscaping practices that benefit water quality, but one of the main principles is also providing for wildlife, especially with all the development that we have been seeing in recent years.
Okay, that makes sense. And then how did you have to undergo a certain kind of training to become an instructor of this form of landscaping?
My parents both worked in environmental protection and horticulture, so that's where my name comes into play. Not named after Forrest Gump. I'm actually named after the rainforest.
Okay.
So I kind of grew up around Florida's ecology and native plants and our ornamental plants and just trying to promote the Florida-friendly landscaping.
Sure.
Native plants are the big focus of this particular class.
Yeah. So what are the hallmarks, would you say, of Florida-friendly landscaping?
You are mainly trying to get people to limit their lawn to what is functional, so what they're actively using to recreate on. You're trying to get people to use less fertilizer, less water, put in plants that are going to thrive in our climate. So instead of roses or hydrangeas or things from up north, trying to put in native or Florida-friendly plants that are suited for our climate.
I see. So if you had too many roses or too big of a lawn or whatever, then that would sort of compromise the whole point there of the Florida-friendly landscaping.
Yeah, those are like very high maintenance, high input. You got to use a lot of pesticides and a lot of fertilizers to keep those things happy here.
Yeah. And it sounds like one of the many virtues of this kind of landscaping is that if done right, and probably after taking the class you would know how to do it right, is that it can attract all these kind of different critters, birds and bees and butterflies and small animals. So what aspect of the landscape determines how effectively the landscaping does attract those insects and birds and small critters? I mean, are there certain things that, like, proportionate to something else, you're going to have a better chance of attracting those kinds of...
You can really cater your landscape towards what you're trying to attract. Like, a lot of plants are only pollinated by bees or butterflies, or they're very good berry-producing or nut-producing plants for squirrels or birds. But the things that I would say that are, like, most important is to have, like, layers in your landscape. So you're going to have, instead of just turf and maybe one tree, trying to put in shrubs and bunch grasses, places for shelter and habitat for these this wildlife, and then also trying to pick native plants, like especially keystone species for our area, that are going to do, you're going to get the most bang for your buck for what they're going to attract.
I see. This sounds really cool. And if I'm not mistaken, I think after the class, which, by the way, we'll go over the details in one sec about the class and how to register. But if I'm not mistaken, right after the class, you can take a tour of the pollinator, so-called pollinator garden at Twin Lakes Park, which is, I guess, class or adjacent to the where the class is being held, correct? So you can kind of see, like, how it's done and its best form, presumably.
Yes. So we have a really nice demonstration garden that are run by our Master Gardener volunteers. And that's my favorite component of the class, is taking people outside and looking at these plants, smelling them, and seeing what they attract firsthand. Like, our native tea bush is probably our top bee bush. And right now it's been in full bloom, and there's like 1,000 different species of insects on this plant.
Oh, wow.
And just looking at it and seeing, helping people identify the different things. Like, so many people have never seen what a larval lady beetle looks like, and pointing that out and saying, this is one of the most beneficial insects you can have in your landscape.
That's very cool.
Why we needed not use pesticides that could kill it, that type of thing.
Right, and the virtues of the Florida-friendly landscaping and right up close in front of you there. So, all right, well, we're sort of almost out of our time here for us, but let's go over the details. So, again, this class is happening on Thursday, June 27th from 9 to 10 a.m. It's part of the UFIFAS Extension Sarasota County, and it's being held at Twin Lakes Park, 6700 Clark Road in Sarasota. And I think to register, there's like a specific email, right? Like ufsarasotatext.eventbrite.com, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes. So our registration is through our Eventbrite, but also you're welcome to just walk in. It's a free class. We'll have enough seats.
Oh, that's great. Okay. I didn't realize that. That's fantastic. Great. So great opportunity for anybody interested in finding out more about how this works and how they can improve their own landscaping and garden areas that way. So that's great. So Forrest, thank you so much for joining us today on Talking Animals. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Take care.
Take care.
All right. We have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals. Coming up next, it's Slice of Life, the wonderful show hosted by Randy Zimmerman and others. After that, we shift back to music, programming with Jim Bannon, 1 to 3, followed by Nancy C. from 3 to 6 with the Traffic Jam. And then our terrific Wednesday night block of Latin music extends. WNF Tampa. Thanks.